Mr. Whitehead.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. James Whitehead representing the Exelon family of companies. This case presents the Court with two issues.
Has the Exelon family of companies ever been misclassified on attempting to enter the United States?
Not to my knowledge. I trust they are not a representative. Excuse me, they are not a member of the putative class.
We don't know yet who's a member of
don't
that
know.
Class.
There are two issues in this case. The first is whether or not Exelon has agreed to deal with IBEW Local 15 as the representative of retired workers through the grievance arbitration procedure in the company's collective bargaining agreement with respect to claims that these retired workers will be making or have made that Exelon has...
Let me tell you what my problem is with that way of phrasing the question. A different way of understanding what's happened here is that there is a collective bargaining agreement between the employer and the union, of which the retirees are third-party beneficiaries. If that's what's happened, the employer and union don't need to be representatives. Anybody can engage in a contract that bestows a benefit on a third party, even if the third party doesn't consent. And then I assume that people who have written this contract can agree to renegotiate the contract. If we look at this as a third-party beneficiary contract, does it matter whether any retiree has consented to anything?
I think it does matter, Judge, with respect to the question not of their right to bring the claims. That's not disputed here. The question is, where must they bring those claims? And the union's position is that the collective bargaining agreement allows those claims to be brought by the union as the representative of a small group of these retirees under the...
The question I'm asking is, isn't it best to conceive of this claim as the union on behalf of itself as the negotiator of this contract that has third-party benefits?
The union might articulate it that way, Judge, but we wouldn't agree, and I don't think this Court's decision in the Rosetto versus Pabst Brewing Company case would make it appropriate for the analysis to be that way. In Pabst, this Court made it very clear that claims that retired workers may have under collective bargaining agreement...
Well, I'm not being very successful in getting you to address my question. The claim that was being made in Rosetto was explicitly a claim by retirees, and then the union needs authority to act as their agent. The question I'm asking is, suppose we forget about this as a claim by retirees and treat it as a claim by the union, as the author of a third-party beneficiary contract.
Your Honor, that has not been the way in which this case has been presented by the union in the court below or in this court for that matter. The question, it seems to me, is whose rights are at issue here? Pabst, I believe, answers that question and establishes that the rights at issue, the rights that need to be protected in connection with changes to retiree medical benefits, are the rights of the individual employees. And this Court, in fact, expressed great concern in the Rosetto case that the union, perhaps representing a small number of those retired workers, would not be permitted to hijack the claims of the remaining individuals. We do not dispute that the retired workers from Exelon may have rights as third-party beneficiaries under the collective bargaining agreement. We acknowledge that those claims can be brought, and indeed should be brought, under Section 301 of the Labor Management Relations Act.
Look, putting questions about forfeiture to one side, just forget about this as a collective bargaining agreement. Company X takes out an insurance policy on the life of its managers, or even law firm X takes out an insurance policy on the life of its partners, right? And a dispute arises about the coverage that's provided by the insurance policy. I take it that the partner or the manager is not the sole proper party to negotiate with the insurance company, may not indeed be a proper party.
I would agree with that.
That the person who can negotiate is the law firm or the company that took out the policy. The third-party beneficiary can, in principle, be bypassed. The question I'm asking is why that's not proper here, to just take the third-party beneficiary and forget about it and allow the union and the employer to resolve their differences.
I think the reason for that, Your Honor, going back to the Supreme Court's decision in the Pittsburgh Plate Glass case and also as reflected in the Pabst case, is because of the potential for inherent conflicts of interest between the union...
There's a potential for conflict of interest between the law firm and its partners about what the insurance coverage is.
Well, not in the same way...
In every third-party beneficiary case, the person who negotiated for the benefit may end up in disagreement with the beneficiary.
Well, Your Honor, if the upshot of Your Honor's analysis is then that the union on its own behalf can proceed to arbitration of these matters without obtaining the consent of any of the retirees, then it would seem to me that we have the quintessential hijacking problem that this Court identified in Rosetto and that the Cleveland Electric case in the Sixth Circuit has recognized as well.
I'd like you to forget about Rosetto, and you know, maybe this way of looking at things has been forfeited. But you don't have any doubt that the next time the collective bargaining agreement comes up for renegotiation, Exelon, the management, and the union can negotiate about what the retirees' benefits in the future will be freely and without getting any retirees' consent whatsoever, right?
They can, certainly with respect to the future retiree benefits of current workers who are within the collective bargaining agreement. That would be a mandatory, within the current unit, that would be a mandatory subject of bargaining.
And for retirees from retirement years past, it's a permissive subject of collective bargaining. Therefore, the union and the management can negotiate and contract about it without any retirees' consent. Right?
I would accept that subject to the breach of the duty of fair representation.
Exactly. They can do it. Well, if it is permissible to negotiate about this subject and form a wholly new contract or amend the contract in a way that affects the retirees, why is it not permissible to arbitrate in a way that affects the retirees?
I submit, Your Honor, that the courts have recognized this inherent conflict of interest. I can't analogize it to a law firm.
There's got to be identical situations. If the union can negotiate for retirees' future benefits to negotiate a new CBA, then it can arbitrate. And if it can't do one, it can't do the other either. I just don't understand a position in which one says the union and Exelon can freely negotiate about this subject without the permission of any, let alone all, retirees. But they can't arbitrate about this subject without the permission of all retirees.
Judge, I would acknowledge that the negotiations over the retiree medical rights is a permissive subject. But I would submit that the doctrine of duty of fair representation would strongly cabin the ability of the company and the union now to say, we're going to jettison the rights for our current retirees in order to free up additional money for our current workers with respect to their future retirement benefits.
That kind of deal is struck all the time, often at the request of management.
It may well be at the request of management, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it'll pass muster in the event that it is subject to challenge. I think the concern that the Supreme Court in the Pittsburgh Plate Glass case recognized about this inherent conflict between the interests of the union with respect to its current members, the current workers at a company like Exelon, and the interests of retired workers is palpable. I think that drives this whole analysis. That's what certainly drove this court's analysis in Rosetto because of the concern that the union may be more interested in protecting the rights of its current members than it is in protecting the rights of its former members, the persons who have currently retired. And that's why the second part of the Rosetto case, the requirement that the union obtain consent from each of the retirees, I think is quite sensible. Because, as this Court recognized in Rosetto, as a practical matter, that arbitration decision that results from the arbitration brought by the union will be binding and will, in fact, determine the rights of the non-consenting retirees. But we have a more fundamental issue, I think, in this case, and that is, has Exelon agreed in the grievance arbitration procedure in this contract to allow disputes with respect to the rights of retirees to be arbitrated? In the Rosetto case, this Court found clear language that indicated that the parties had not agreed that retiree grievances could be maintained under the grievance arbitration procedure. I would submit that the language that is contained in the Exelon collective bargaining agreement is at least as clear. And indeed, if Your Honors were to look at that language, it's in Article 8 of the collective bargaining agreement, which is set forth in our appendix. You will see time and time and time again the specific language of the procedure contemplates only grievances over disputes and differences between the company and its employees. At no time anywhere in that arbitration procedure is there any reference to disputes involving former employees or former retirees or retired workers. And thus, this language is at least as clear as that in Rosetto. Now, the district court seemed to conclude that because the right at issue, the right to retiree medical benefits, was itself a creature of the collective bargaining agreement, then by definition, as a matter of law, that it must be arbitrable. But of course, that was the question, that was the case in Rosetto as well. There was no dispute in Rosetto that the retiree benefits at issue in that case arose out of the collective bargaining agreement. And yet this court quite correctly determined that the fact that the source of the rights is the collective bargaining agreement does not answer the separate question of whether or not those rights can be enforced through the grievance arbitration procedure as opposed to being enforced through a separate action under Section 301 of the Labor Management Relations Act. In Rosetto, again, the court found the reference to employees
would
in the arbitration.
Section 301, or would it be under ERISA?
It could be under both, Judge. Most of these cases would be brought as a hybrid or brought both with a 301 action or an ERISA action. Clearly, as it relates to...
Suppose the alternative is that one retiree brings an action under ERISA, represented by the union's lawyer,
yes,
Mr. Hoffman, and ask the district court to certify a class of all retirees. Would that make you happier?
Well, it would indicate that the case is in the proper venue, and so we would understand that that is the appropriate location, that is the appropriate venue for these matters to be resolved. We're not trying to run away from these claims. There is an appropriate vehicle or procedure for these claims to be maintained.
Then I'm lost. Your essential point here is that it's not enough that six or seven retirees have authorized the union to act for them. You think every single one of them has to authorize it by signing on the dotted line. But in the alternative I've just exposed, one is enough and the rest of them will just be ignored.
Judge, the requirement of unanimity flows from this court's decision in Pabst, and I think that is because the court felt, and I think correctly so, that an arbiter's interpretation of the collective bargaining agreement, whether in an arbitration involving all of the retirees or only a few of the retirees, will, as a practical matter, determine the rights of each of them. And under those circumstances, it is appropriate, given that each of these individuals enjoy these rights as individuals, they are personal to them, that they ought not to be bound by a proceeding in which they do not participate as a practical matter. Now, if in fact
it's always comforting to see employers showing up as the champion of the put-upon retirees, I would feel more comfortable that the retirees view themselves as put-upon if one of them showed up and said, we're unhappy.
Well, Your Honor, in the absence of any of those poor retirees, we're the best they've got. And in truth, of course, with respect to the argument that we have not agreed to deal with the union under the grievance arbitration procedure, that clearly is our argument. That is a right that Exelon has as a result of the negotiations. We simply have not agreed to deal with the union with respect to retiree grievances through the grievance arbitration procedure, as this court felt was necessary in the Rosetto case. And we think, as I said, that the language of the grievance arbitration procedure here is even clearer than that in Rosetto in precluding grievances brought by the union on behalf of non-employees. If there are no further questions, I'd reserve the balance of my time for my rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. Hoffman.
Good morning. Arthur Hoffman on behalf of Local 15. The Rosetto case simply does not say that if you are an aggrieved retiree and you want the union to represent your interests in an arbitration, you have to go out and get the consent of every other retiree who's similarly situated as you. The case does not say that.
What is the union's position with respect to the question I asked?
About the third-party beneficiary?
Yeah. Is it the union's position that it doesn't need any retirees to consent?
Are you talking about to negotiate something or to bring the arbitration?
Both.
Your Honor, I would say to bring an arbitration to litigate retiree issues, I would say that the union needs the consent of at least one retiree. And the reason I think
that if you're Mr. Whitehead argued forfeiture, you're now waiving the point. I don't know why, but
I'm not waiving the point, Your Honor. What I'm saying is
waive the point.
What I'm saying is, in terms of third-party contract beneficiary, the U.S. Supreme Court has said that when it comes to retiree rights, it's a permissive issue of bargaining. And so what the Supreme Court says is that if the union is going to represent a retiree, the retiree has a choice to make.
You may not have listened carefully to my question. My question is, since the retirees are third-party beneficiaries of the contract between the union and Exelon, I asked in a general way whether it is ever necessary for the third-party beneficiary to participate in either the negotiation or arbitration or litigation that is commenced by the person who negotiated for this benefit. Now, my understanding of the normal private law, normal contract law, is that the person who bestowed the benefit on the third party can negotiate, arbitrate, litigate, what have you, without the presence of the third-party beneficiary.
I would agree with that as a general proposition.
Is there some reason why labor law is different?
The only reason I'm hesitant when it comes to labor law is if you look at the there's a section of the Rosetto opinion that talked about Article 3.
The Rosetto opinion does not discuss this question. It was common ground in Rosetto that the retirees own the claim. Now, whether that was peculiar to the contract or just the party's litigation strategy, that was the assumption on which the court proceeded. I'm asking whether that assumption is true in this case. Now,
I see your question.
Given the fact that the union has never made this argument, Mr. Whitehead has invoked the rule of forfeiture, and it sounded to me like you've just waived the argument. We perhaps just need to reserve it for some future case where issue has been joined.
I think I understand the question now, Your Honor. Let me see if I've got it. I think you're saying is that because the union is a party to the contract, and it therefore has Article 3 standing to litigate the contract that it negotiated and that it signed, does it need the third-party beneficiary standing by its side to so litigate?
My question has nothing to do with Article 3 or standing, all of which are irrelevant in arbitration, but you're coming closer.
Okay.
Anyway, it's given the position of both sides, I just assume this issue is not presented in this case. We'll resolve it in some future case.
Okay. The issue I'm dealing with, Your Honor, is that there is nothing in either Rosetto or any other case that says if a retiree chooses, because it's a permissive area, if a retiree chooses to have the union represent its interest, that it has to go out and get the consent of everybody else. Okay. Rosetto was a very unique situation where the court talked about the parallel actions that were going on. A district court class action and an arbitration going on at the same time. And when the court was talking about the issue that Mr. Whitehead was talking about in terms of if the union loses, do the retirees lose, it was talking about a what-if situation. What if we allow the union to represent even those who have not consented? Are we going to be destroying their rights to bring an individual action in a federal district court? And that was the concern there. The concern was the court was saying, if we allow the union to represent people who haven't consented, we're worried that we're taking away their individual rights. That is not a problem here, Judge, because the district court's ruling said that the union can go ahead and arbitrate on behalf of the people who have consented to union arbitration. So there is no hijacking of anybody else's rights. There is no hijacking of anybody else's claims. Under due process law, going all the way back to Hansberry versus Lee, the retirees who have not consented to union representation are not going to be bound by the result in the arbitration. There simply is no hijacking of claims. On the other side, where Exelon talks about we have not agreed to arbitrate any type of retiree claims, I think it's very important to talk about the year 2001, which is when this arbitration agreement was entered into as part of the collective bargaining agreement. In 2001, it was after many, many years of, through the collective bargaining agreement, creating retiree rights. And in 2001, Exelon agreed to arbitrate two different types of claims having to do with working conditions and claims that had to do with interpretations of CBA provisions. Now, in 2001, this was 14 years after this court's decision in Nero that said if you have a broad arbitration provision, there's going to be a presumption in favor of arbitrability. And 14 years after Nero, Exelon agreed to an arbitration provision that said any dispute over any CBA provision shall be settled by arbitration. It didn't say any dispute over any CBA provision having to do with employees only but not retirees. It said any dispute over any CBA provision. Again, we're talking about 2001 when this agreement was entered into. This is now 4 years after Rosetto, where this court told the world at large, here's how you do it if you want. Here's how to do it if you want to do it. If you don't want to include retirees' rights, put it right in the CBA provision, put it right in the arbitration clause, and have it say we're only covering claims between the company and its employees. That was the clause that was at issue in Rosetto. Do they do that here? No. We have an arbitration clause that covers disputes between the company and its employees or between the company and the union. And when we're talking about disputes between the company and the union, those are the disputes that are entirely and appropriately directed at interpretations of the CBA that the union negotiated and that the union signed on to. And so Exelon did not take advantage of the Rosetto decision. They did not limit the arbitration clause to only disputes between the company and its employees. They signed on to a clause that included the union, and they signed on to a clause that included any provision under the CBA. So we look at the presumption that's in the Nero case, the presumption that's in the Cleveland Electric case, and we say, what have they got that says that retiree disputes should not be included? The answer is there simply is no express provision saying retiree disputes are excluded. The provision that counsel is talking about that has to do with the procedure for dealing with grievances involving employees is just a natural consequence of the fact that the arbitration clause covers disputes over working conditions. Working conditions are always going to involve employees. And so if there's a dispute over working conditions, you have to have the involvement of an employee. Not so with regard to a dispute over a CBA provision. That's simply a contractual dispute. It has nothing to do with any particular employee. It has to do with interpreting the provision. And Exelon did nothing in this CBA to exclude CBA provisions having to do with retirees from the arbitration process. Now, is there a statement in Rosetto that says if the District 10 loses an arbitration, the retirees lose, comma, period? Yes, that statement is in there. But I urge you to reach the same conclusion that the district court did, that that statement is being lifted out of context, because the paragraph where that statement appears is a paragraph where the Seventh Circuit was responding to the suggestion of why don't we allow both cases to proceed along parallel paths, the district court class action and the arbitration. And in my view, all the Seventh Circuit was doing there was saying we cannot allow both cases to proceed on simultaneous paths because we're going to run headlong into the doctrine of res judicata. You can't let the retirees' claims be litigated through the union.
On parallel paths, and then it's the doctrine of RACE judicata.
I agree with you, Judge, but that's not the situation here. We don't have parallel paths here. We have an arbitration proceeding brought by the union representing seven retirees, and there is no parallel case going on in district court where somebody is trying to represent those same seven people. They are having one bite at the apple, not two, and no other retiree is going to be bound by a decision that they're not a party to. Every case that the counsel cited in his brief was always a situation where
Why not? I assume that if the union and the six or seven retirees prevail in this arbitration, the next thing that will happen is a Section 301 action, or maybe an ERISA action by the remaining retirees or by the union as their representative, seeking to bind the employer under the normal approach of offensive non-mutual issue preclusion. Right? It'll invoke blonder tongue, in other words. Isn't that the sequence you have in mind?
What I have in mind is getting through this arbitration first, okay?
Yeah, and then what happens next?
If we prevail on the issue, we would expect, we would sit back and ask Exelon, are you going to apply this arbitrator's ruling across the board? If the answer is yes, there's no need to take any further action. If the answer is no, we would ask why not? And if we don't get a sufficient answer, there could be subsequent action. But that in no way is a situation where anybody's claims have been hijacked.
Counsel, you have to stop talking when a judge starts. The question I had is, what will the theory of that next action be? Will it be we're going to litigate from scratch because the arbitrator was right and we're going to show that it was right? Or is the union going to say, the arbitrator's decision is conclusive, see blonder tongue?
Judge, my research in terms of using offensive collateral estoppel based on an arbitration proceeding tells me that that's anything but a foregone conclusion. It's a difficult concept to apply. Being an advocate, would I take a shot at it? Absolutely. But we're talking about what ifs down the road here. I'm talking about a situation where right here and now there is no situation where any retiree's claim is being hijacked. What, in fact, it's just the opposite. It's Exelon who's trying to hijack the claim of the seven retirees who elected to make the union their representative, as the Rosetto case says is their right, that they have the right to make the union their representative. And Exelon is trying to undo that action that those seven retirees have taken. I would raise just one last point, Your Honor, when it comes to the issue of what happens at the result at the end of this arbitration. Let's have a hypothetical, and let's talk about the potential arbitration on behalf of the people who are still employees. Because remember, that's part of this claim, too. This arbitration was brought to adjudicate the rights of those who are still employees who haven't retired yet, and on behalf of the consenting retirees. Under Exelon's theory, because we're talking about the same contractual provision, that somehow if this went to arbitration just on behalf of the employees and the employees...
I hate to interrupt you, Mr. Hoffman, but I've got a question for you. I probably should have asked Mr. Whitehead first. And I'm worried in this litigation, when you say what is going to happen next, what worries me is I can't really tell what's going to happen because, so far as I can see, the district court hasn't entered a final judgment yet. It's actually not clear to me that we have appellate jurisdiction. There is a document in the appendix to Mr. Whitehead's brief purporting to be a judgment that says one side's motion for summary judgment is granted and the other's is denied. But I can't find a document setting out the relief to which the prevailing party is entitled. And this strikes me as a case in which the relief is potentially important. What actually has to happen next? Is there some document in which the district court sets out the relief to which the union is entitled?
Your Honor, the union did not file the claim in district court, so it was filed by Exelon, and the relief...
Yes, I understand, but the union is the prevailing party. What a judgment does is set out the relief to which the prevailing party is entitled.
Okay, I understand your question. At the end of the...
What, in your view, should happen. I'm asking whether there is a document in which the district court sets that out.
I believe at the end of the district court's summary judgment opinion...
Opinions don't count. Opinions explain judgments. They are not themselves judgments.
I agree. I was simply trying to answer your question. I thought you said, is there a document that explains...
By document, I was meaning a judgment-like thing.
Okay. If the question is there a judgment that says, here's what happens next. I don't know the answer to that question.
All right. Okay, well, thank you very much. Mr. Whitehead, is there one?
I think I can anticipate my first question. There is no document other than that set forth in page 15 of the appendix. I would interpret that document, Judge, as indicating that the judgment of the court is that Exelon's prayers for declaratory and injunctive relief are denied. I believe that is what the effect of the judge's judgment was. But other than the document set forth on page 15 of the appendix, there is no such document.
What does that mean concretely? Maybe that's the right way to understand it. But
we were seeking Exelon.
Yeah.
I apologize. Exelon was seeking a declaration that it was not obligated to pursue to allow this claim to be processed through arbitration.
So you've not been ordered to arbitration.
I beg your pardon?
You have not been ordered to arbitration.
We have not, but the functional effect of what the district court did was to rule that Exelon's request for a declaration that it had no such obligation was denied.
Yes.
I think Exelon certainly, Judge Exelon certainly understands that if this court affirms that.
Now, if that's true, well, now, I'm trying to think this through. If all that has happened in this case is that Exelon has sought a declaratory judgment that it doesn't need to arbitrate, and the district judge has said, I refuse to enter such a declaratory judgment, period. Nothing else is decided. Is the issue that you're debating on this appeal how many people have to consent, even presented by this case?
Well, I think the district court did more than simply.
Since the district court didn't order arbitration, it didn't confirm. It obviously didn't confirm an award because it couldn't. It didn't say Exelon's refusal to participate in the arbitration so far means that it's forfeited, that it's lost in some way. It may be that the issue you're seeking to present is not really before us. If that's all that happened here.
And I recognize Your Honor's hypothetical, but I do believe that the district court's decision was more than simply saying, I'm not going to grant declaratory relief.
How could it be more than that when we agree that there is no judgment more than that? More than go away is the judgment.
I understand Your Honor's quandary in that regard. I believe that the effect of the judgment was to confirm that the district court declared that this matter was appropriate for arbitration.
Right. He surely didn't do that.
A declaratory
judgment was requested and none was entered. Right? If the judge had said, I declare that Exelon must arbitrate, yeah, maybe, but he didn't.
Well, and there unfortunately
well, look,
was.
Look, since we're all coming to this fresh, I'm just trying to think it through. Obviously, both of you are thinking it through. I'll give the parties 10 days to file supplemental memos until a week from Friday, addressing the question what, if any, judgment has been entered in this case, and therefore whether, if the only judgment is that no declaratory judgment of any kind will be issued, whether the issues on which the parties have filed their briefs are even properly presented in this case. Now, of course, one option is to go and ask the district court to enter a proper judgment. And then you might want to file a new notice of appeal from that. But I don't think we can just assume that there is an implied judgment in invisible ink.
We will file something by a week from Friday. Judge, I have just, if I may, very quickly.
I'll give you a minute.
I've been thinking about Your Honor's third-party beneficiary analysis of this case. It seems to me that the position of the union vis-a-vis the retired employees is perhaps better analogized to that of an agency relationship, where the agent has entered into a contract on behalf of other principals, in this case the retirees. And the question then becomes whether or not the agent, in the agent's own name, has the right to take action vis-a-vis those rights of those principals. I think inherent in the Supreme Court's Pittsburgh Plate Glass decision and this Court's Rosetta decision is the notion that the union does not have its own rights at stake with respect to the arbitration of claims brought on behalf of the retired workers. I think that is the analysis that I think would be appropriately applied here. And then finally, very briefly, the union continues to rely upon a single sentence from Section 5 of the arbitration procedure. But, Your Honor, as we explain in our brief, if one reads Sections 2, Sections 3, Sections 4, Section 6, you see the word employee and not retiree.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for
Thank
your
you
opinion.
Very much.
Thank you, Pat.
The case is taken under advisement, and we look forward to receiving memos from both parties by a week from Friday.